guys, welcome. This is the first installment of a podcast that has yet to be named. We're going to see what this is. We're still not quite sure yet, but we're just going to roll with it and see where it goes. So
I might have a name.
Why don't we just do this? What did you say?
Island Boys.
The Island Boys. Yes.
Okay, the Island Boys.
The Island Boys. That it makes sense for 75% of the participants of this podcast. 75% of the people, I'll let you guys guess which 75% have lived in Hawaii. So we kicked around the Island Boys. There's a few other ones that are so good that I don't even want to mention them yet, unless someone run out and steal our IP. or steal our not IP. What's the URLs? Yeah, we got to keep them close to the vest, yeah. So we won't mention them. But why don't we just do this? We'll just introduce ourselves. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media. We exist to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Oshawa, why don't you go next?
My name is Oshawa Hawthorne. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm the executive director of a ministry called Brilliance Labs. We're essentially a faith-driven, kingdom startup incubator. We help ministries and churches get started, and we're also trying to explore ways that Bitcoin can be leveraged for global work. And particularly Christian faith-based work.
Ryan Finley from Roseburg, Oregon, about 3 hours south of Osh. I'm the founder of Tracker, or co-founder of Tracker Software. It's a publishing software that my son and I have been building, and also have a media company. Have a father of six kids. Been working a lot with them, just them getting started in life and starting their own companies and businesses. So, yeah.
Whoop, whoop. Yeah, I'm Matt Purvis. I'm actually on the island, the only one of the four on the island right now, Big Island. And I've known these guys other than Jordan for a long time. But we're all involved in the church plant here, still pastoring, grassroots church here, business owner, cafe, bakery, and I'm always trying more things than I should be doing. Farming, other stuff like that, but father of six also.
Nice. Let's go, man. Well, so Matt, I don't know if you've ever heard this saying, but the saying goes that anything worth being done well is worth doing worth doing poorly. Have you heard of this?
Oh yeah, living it.
It's such a good one. All right, so let's go around the horn here, because we basically have talked about fatherhood being one of the things that we're going to address on here at certain points. So let's go around and give our fatherhood bona fides here. So I've got four kids right now. My wife is pregnant with number five. Let's go around the horn again.
Yeah, we're getting started. We just had number eight. So I have an 18-year-old as the oldest that's graduating high school, and then about a 10-week-old.
Boom.
Awesome.
And everything in between.
That's, yeah, Ryan, you mentioned awesome. You had six, and then Matt.
Yeah, we have six. We had, oldest is 19, youngest is 5 and a half, almost six. We had three boys in a row and then three girls in a row, which is awesome because I compartmentalized my little seasons of
of parenting.
I'm focusing on sending the three boys out, and then I'll focus on the three girls.
The three girls have three older brothers. That's great.
Yep.
Yeah.
To watch
extra
out for.
Help.
Yeah. A protector extra for each one. That's right. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
Cool. I've got six from 13 years old down to 8 months. And, I was with these guys in Hawaii when they were just, their kids were little. So they were definitely a big part of our inspiration to go for it, and got to see how they're training and everything else. So yeah,
love it. And just for the record, we are not Mormon, okay? And neither are we Roman Catholic. So Mormons and Roman Catholics in disbelief that there are Protestants in the world that have so many kids. So we will probably get into more about that at a different time. But basically the structure of this podcast for right now is going to be, we've been on Twitter, okay? We've been on Twitter. We spend, we could argue about how much time we spend on Twitter. But we spend time on Twitter. We come across things that we like and that we enjoy for various reasons. And so what we want to do is just kind of take some time to share a tweet that we found and enjoyed. Basically, the main structure is each of these ones that we share is going to be something that, that we found helpful or interesting or thought worthy of you know, more quote unquote serious discussion for 10 to 15, 20 minutes each. And then we'll have a little, we're still trying to figure out other segments. We might have a more lighthearted segment full of tweets at the end. If we find, you know, our favorite memes or memes of the week or something along those lines. So we'll see where this goes. But Ash, I will let you lead this week, because I think your tweet, if you're going to still use the one you mentioned, leads into mine. So then it'll have like a good intro.
Okay, I'll get us started. So this was a tweet from Christianity Today that made the rounds, and it was an article that they shared, and I'll read their post, and they got like noted, readers added context, community notes, and then I'm going to share a retweet, okay? So Christianity Today shares an article that the Bible doesn't say Jesus was nailed to a cross, posted on Easter weekend. One evangelical Bible scholar thinks the crucifixion may have been done with ropes. And then, of course, the community notes is that the Bible explicitly says that Jesus' wounds in his hands and his side following his crucifixion, burial, and resurrection. And they quote John 20:27. And so I want to share the retweet. And then actually, I'll share my perspective. I retweeted it too. But this guy, David Mitzenmacher, he says this. He says, I am encouraged by the broad coalition from Big Eva to Little Eva, Calvinists and Arminians, Baptists and Presbys, PWC respecters and CN bros, pastors and professors and laymen, all joining together with one voice to say that Christianity Today under Russell Moore is a dumpster fire. So,
all right. tell us more. Show us more. Can you share your screen so we can see the tweet?
So I'm not able to.
Oh yeah, you can't.
Yeah,
all
it's right. Yeah, it's okay. So then my comment. So I actually have a subscription to Christianity Today, because I went to a large mission conference and they gave it to me for free. And so you can't actually read this. So I imagine this article goes around and people see the headline and they're like, that's stupid. I'm going to retweet that and complain. So I actually did the hard work of clicking the link and entering my credentials so that I could read the article behind the paywall without actually paying Christianity Today anything to do that. And my post was, hey, you don't hate this article enough. Because really, the heart of the issue was that just kind of in passing, they include this the text, John 20:27, and they say, well, yeah, hey, look, like the Greek, it seems to say that he was crucified, that there were nails in his hands, and that's what Thomas felt, right? The hand puts his hand in his in the side and in his hands, and the article just brushes it aside and says, well, John was a late gospel. And so it probably, and then they infer that therefore that was changed, and that the view that crucifixion used nails was a later view. And so because John is written probably, right, later, maybe 90 AD or something, they extrapolated the later view of crucifixion and imposed it on the actual historical event of Thomas feeling the hands and the side. And it just says that in passing. And so what struck me was that this article, it didn't just call inerrancy into question. It actually was saying, yeah, John's gospel is a... cannot be relied upon, and to actually give the details of what happened, and like, for at what cost do you throw aside biblical reliability? Well, so you can speculate about the possibility of maybe it was ropes, and get more hits, and so yes, it went viral, and then eventually the author, who is also a senior editor, apologizes, and then other Christianity Today guys like Cosper goes on and says, this takes so much guts to come and apologize and take responsibility.
He didn't apologize. And, yeah, it's
yeah, he did. He did apologize.
No, he didn't. It's like a halfway apology. It's like a halfway apology. It's just not.
I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings.
Yeah. Well, he says I didn't realize essentially that I was inferring a denial of inerrancy in my article. And then my response, I tweeted this, was like, well, where are the editors? Should we also infer an apology from the editors? We infer that they didn't realize that they were questioning the reliability of the Bible. Yeah. So I think I agree with this perspective that Christianity Today, yeah, has so gone so far to appease the progressive portion of the church that it's just willing to say just utterly asinine things. And I don't know if it's to get clicks and views or just because they've lost that theological backbone, but I'm unimpressed. I'm also frustrated because this is actually a valuable institution within Christendom and within the kind of modern evangelical movement that it really is lame that I feel like it's been co-opted. So yeah. I would wish it would come back. That's my perspective on it.
All right, I'll let you before I pull out my my flamethrower. I'll let maybe some of the more winsome potentially voices, in the hope that there are some more winsome voices among the other two brothers here. I'll let you guys. Did you guys see this? What did you think about it? Has Osh kind of summarized?
Yeah, I got something I could say about that. And from a pastoral angle, currently still pastoring. And so you're saying, where's the editors? And I guess I'm saying, where's the pastors in there? Like, aren't these guys pastors, for crying out loud? And I didn't dig into this too deeply, by the way. I did see it. But I'll give you a quick story of like someone who's barely new to the faith in my church who has dreadlocks with seashells woven into them and stuff like that. And, he got picked up hitchhiking and someone told him something about how you can't rely on the Bible. You can't trust the Bible because X, Y, Z, and something about how you're saying Jesus's name wrong. So therefore you're like blaspheming God and stuff. And, thankfully I was able to, I hit him pretty hard, which is not my usual. And he responded really well to it and doesn't think those stupid things anymore. Yeah. But maybe you guys could adjust my framing of it, but there's nothing wrong with having any discussion about the Bible, questioning the cross, questioning the nails, anything, any conversation. But there's a reason why the ivory tower is the ivory tower and how that flows down to popular level. And it's not a matter of being a mystery religion or hiding anything, but it's a matter of like you're throwing out like just as Osh said, you're throwing out a massive dose of doubt in John's reliability and in the general trustworthiness of the scripture without any real caveats, when that conversation belongs in a different place, if at all, So Mr. Dreadlock Seashells, if he comes across this, that's a whole new thing. And every other young Christian. So where's the pastors?
Ryan, go for it, man.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they've just gone down the path of, that's just a sensational claim. I have a hard time believing that they didn't know that it was just going to stir up a big controversy. I've long since stopped following them, like a lot of mainstream, I don't want to call them just a news institution, but they're just going to, it's just going to further slide them into irrelevancy. And it's just kind of sad because it got a lot of headlines and, I didn't look into it too much. It's just like, ugh. Yeah. Just it was just another reminder of why I don't really pay attention to them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, a lot of my issue with it, it wasn't just that it was published, it was when it was published.
Yeah.
Like, this is like the day before Easter. It's like the day before we're celebrating the resurrection, and these guys are, these yokels are sitting here just randomly bringing up this random scholar who is like completely outside of 2,000 years of church history, and like just to try to just drop this in your big article you're dropping the day before. It just seems like such a bonkers thing. I'll give you my response, which was it's actually conveniently right here below. Mine was basically something to this effect. Congrats, guys. Your tweet went viral. You have your reward. You sowed totally warrantless doubt in the minds of the people of God for clout from the biblically illiterate and to bring in more money from those unaware that you're parading around in a Buffalo Bill-style skin suit of the publication you once were. There's a long tradition of that type of thing during this season. Unfortunately, it's from Judas. I just think like...
Was that your more compassionate take?
Listen, I definitely edited, I'll tell you. But yeah, no, I just think like these are people who know what they're doing. Like these are not people who... Again, these are not new believers. Like that's the reality, is these are people who are... They value the opinions of a group of people, and so they are signaling to those people. Like they are trying to be very winsome and trying to just give a voice to these obscure, ridiculous things that are completely at odds with 2,000 years of church history. And again, I just don't have any kind of patience for these, for this institution in particular. That was followed up by the, and again, I think this is really the big issue, right? Is like, again, you mentioned, Matt, you're sowing totally warrantless doubt. Okay. You know, you got this guy in your church. There's plenty of other people who don't know better. Like mm-hmm. they don't know that there's numerous scriptures that talk about, you know, being nailed to a cross and there being, you know, him having nail holes in his hands. Like there are people who just don't know this. And so this actually sounds probable, you know, sounds at least plausible to them. But even more than that is, again, that they're sitting here raising money. They still are, you know, basically their existence is based on their reputation from decades ago. So they're sitting here propagating these ridiculous things with a name that they inherited from people who would have been mortified, horrified to think that something like this could be published on top of a reputation that they had, on top of hundreds of thousands of hours with the work. I mean, literally probably tens of millions of dollars. I mean, definitely tens of millions of dollars over the course of the history of Christianity today. And again, Christianity Today was founded to be a voice for Orthodox Christianity, small O Orthodox Christianity, in the face of a lot of liberalism. And so this is just, I mean, this is just horrifying. So, yeah, I didn't have any patience for it. Don't have patience for it. Have seen too many things from these people, especially again the editors. So like what's his name, Russell Moore. Again, he's had one thing after another of you know, basically pulling his punches on people who are, who it's politically convenient for him to appeal towards more left-wing people. Yeah. And then being real tough and talking tough when it comes to people who are, you know, to the right of him. So, there's definitely warrant not to, you know, basically not to, or there's definitely warrant to doubt the motives here that are going on and that motivated this kind of a publication. So,
Can I read a scripture that I just pulled up real quick? So it's so important, you know, there's a list of characteristics of false teachers, and I'm not even throwing that necessarily. Let's just say this. If you're not a false teacher, don't act like a false teacher. Let's just say that. If anyone teaches a different doctrine, this is 1 Timothy 6, and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teaching that accords with godliness, and here's the part that's important. He's puffed up with conceit and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy craving for controversy and quarrels about words. I'll just not even finish it because that's the part. So, look, a lot of people, including real believers, have an unhealthy craving for controversy.
Yep.
And, you know, as it says in, I think it's in Isaiah, you know, don't call everything conspiracy that the people call conspiracy. And I would add to it, there is a conspiracy. It's the devil and the world and what the Lord has done in his salvation plan. So that's the conspiracy, guys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the main one. I'm not saying there's no such thing as a conspiracy, but he says you shall fear God, not conspiracies that you hear about. So if you aren't a false teacher, then shed the things that look like you're a false teacher, such as a craving for controversy.
Yeah, and again, like they could honestly say, "Oh, well, we're not trying to be conspiratorial, because you know we're just trying to talk about this scripture," and like there actually is a scholar who's says these things. But again, it's just like the fact that there's some random dude who's completely at odds with 2,000 years of church history. So you're gonna platform that dude the day before we celebrate the resurrection? Like, it's just, I mean, by any measure, it's the dumbest thing you could possibly do. Like, again, this is a nonprofit organization. Okay, so they're not necessarily the most gifted in terms of making money. Maybe strategy isn't going to be their strong point. But I mean, just even in the most cynical, through the most cynical lens, this was just ridiculous. It was such poor timing for this. But again, if the goal is for the benefit of the church to see these people for who they are, then it was actually a great time. Couldn't have been better. So I'm very grateful that they did what they did.
I mean, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Judas, Oistre, the pagan fertility goddess, they all rely on actual old documents from some idiot that just sat and wrote something down.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that it has any weight,
Exactly. 100%. Okay, now, with that, okay, building off of that, I've got a buddy. His name is Josh. Where'd he go? Oh, come now. Got a buddy. His name is Josh. And he tweeted something. Here's what we're going to do.
We're going to talk about Donald Trump.
No, we're not going to talk about Trump. That was somebody else. That's Ryan. Actually, yeah. Actually, here's what we'll do. Ryan, we'll go to yours, and then we'll come back to mine. So, Ryan, why don't you go for it?
Yeah, so this last week, Trump announced an initiative to basically, the birth rates across the country are falling in every state, I believe. I didn't look up what the new numbers are, but they're far below replacement rate, which is 2.1 kids per woman. Anyways, it started, like, Elon Musk has been raising the alarm bells about this because it is a significant issue. And there's been all sorts of methods across the world that have been tried to encourage, or increase the birth rates. And pretty much nothing has worked anywhere. And it's a lot of, like, throwing money around. And so that's why it was a little bit interesting that the Trump administration came out this last week and basically said that one of the initiatives they want to do is hand out $5,000 in cash to every child that is conceived. And my first take is it's not going to work. I do think financial constraint is, it plays into low birth rates. If individuals are strapped and families are strapped, if living expenses are really, are really high, it's going to cause people to have less kids. I mean, that's just but a one-time, like, $5,000 injection, I mean, it might motivate a few people, but
can you read that tweet where the guy gave the illustration of what that's like?
I have the little note from Riley Norick of the Pirate Wires, that one.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, I'll just read that. I thought it was pretty good. He goes, President Trump is reportedly mulling proposals that would incentivize women to have more babies, including handing out $5,000 in cash for every child conceived. And while this is certainly a worthy problem to tackle, U.S. birth rates are in a free fall, hitting a new low in 2023, I have questions about the proposed solution. If someone's willing to procreate for a quick cash boost worth less than a 2003 Ford Expedition, are they really the type of model citizen we want having more kids? I'm more drawn to other proposals I saw online, like scrapping income tax for families with a certain number of children, a stronger incentive, one focused on family formation as opposed to just child rearing, and one directed towards actual tax contributors, not those just looking for government gibbs. Nevertheless, we should at least applaud the effort here for Trump. The last administration's solution to the population collapse was to invite Tren de Aragua.
Way to go. I like that pronunciation. Let's go.
So, yeah, I do agree with him on his. So he kind of changes it and focuses more on the family formation side. I 100% agree. I should have pulled it up, but marriage rates have been dropping, and I don't know if it's in perfect lockstep with birth rates, but they're both dropping. So basically, the less people that are getting married, the less kids you're going to have, period. Just because, yeah, for lots of different reasons, but I think big one is, if women don't feel secure in a steady marriage, like why would they want to have more children that they're going to potentially have to provide for themselves and take care of that, you know, on their own? But again, I don't think so. Incentivizing family formation, I think that's also good, but again, I don't think it goes deep enough. So I think, you know, there's like a pyramid, you know, focusing on just the financial aspect at the top, that's not going to do it. Family formation is better. But again, I think it goes deeper. I think it goes all the way down to the spiritual. And I think the data backs that up. I think it's, you know, as far as across the world, it's those that are religious are having the most kids. Now, it doesn't mean that policy doesn't play, you know, at least a decent role in it. I'll use one example. There's been, I think, if there's an account on Twitter called More Births. I think I encourage everyone to follow them. They do a really good job of continually highlighting this issue. But I believe I saw a tweet from them where they talked about, so housing costs are really expensive, and the higher housing costs go up, the harder it is for people to have more kids. But the type of house, so we hear a lot about, you know, we need to increase housing and bring the housing costs down. They've pointed out that when you move families into apartments, they have less kids. It's just a natural constraint. So it's the type of housing that really matters. If you build single family homes where there's room to grow, right? Literally, like you have a yard, your own yard, you have extra rooms, just more square, like you have more space, more living room and things like that. You're going to have more kids. So when you see policy at the state level, I live in Oregon and they're pushing apartments being built all over the state as an answer to the housing problem. They're crushing. I mean, I would literally say it's almost anti-human, because if people have less kids when they move into apartments and you only push the construction of apartments, then you're encouraging the birth rates to go down.
And if you're renting, there's actually a legal requirement that they can't rent to you if you have more people than rooms, right? So you can only have two people per bedroom.
Yeah.
If you're renting a two-bedroom apartment, you're only allowed to have two kids.
Yeah.
Right? Husband, wife, and then one other bedroom with two kids. Yeah. Welcome back, Matt. Back, Matt, from your
your
journey with Hawaiian Internet.
The prince of the power of the air tried to get us, but I actually took it as a mercy and went on a much-needed bathroom break. So
there we go. Nice.
Welcome back.
Jehovah Jireh. Let's go.
Yeah. Have you guys noticed his mane? Do you see that ponytail hanging down his shoulder? He's got a full-on... Hawaiian mane. Yeah.
My most passionate daughter will kill me if I ever cut it. So if I ever do cut it, I have to like sell the dog, cut the hair, do everything she doesn't like all at once, you know.
If we're getting back to the article, I think one of the things is, we could talk about Trump, you know, this idea. You could talk about Elon. And I mean, Elon's the other side of this, right? I mean, this is the same core issue of, you know, basically this, all right, we have this problem where people aren't having kids. And so Elon looks at this and goes, hey, I'm doing my part. I've had 13 kids, you know? And so I think a big part of this is that, and this has been kind of something I've been thinking about for a while now, is like, so in the same way that there's ethics of money production, there's also ethics of children production. And so like every kid that you have is not created equally, you know, it's not equally valid, because again, at the end of the day, you're like, well, what is the point? Like, why are we supposed to have kids?
Yeah.
You know, like why does, if you're, you know, if you're framing it as a Christian, like why does God want you to have kids? Is it just that Is it just that having kids is valuable in and of itself? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
Like God in the, I can't remember. It might be Malachi. It's one of the last books of the Old Testament. It basically says that God wants, he's the point of having kids. He wants godly offspring. You know, he wants godly offspring. And I mean, you could go through whether it's statistics or, you know, lived experience, all these kind of things. I mean, basically you can find that children that have a mom and dad, like they do, the outcomes for them are just miles better than those who don't, whether they have two moms, two dads, or just a single parent or a parent and a grandparent, whatever it is. Obviously, there are people who find themselves in those situations. And so that, you know, we're not trying to demean or act like they don't matter or whatever. That's not the goal at all. But to those who would flatly just say it's just about having kids and everybody, you know, as long as kids exist, this is somehow valuable. That's wrong, whether it's Elon saying it, whether it's Trump incentivizing this. You know, I'm not saying he actually believes this, but he's incentivizing just people to continue to do what we're seeing and what the welfare system is already actually subsidizing. Mm-hmm. Like the welfare system already subsidizes this same type of behavior where it just gives blanket checks to, you know, because there are children who exist. So I think that this is, yeah, this is missing the bigger picture. I know a couple people who are, I don't think they were behind this specific decision, but there was another, let me see if I can find it, but who are actually working with administration people and advising them. Maybe somebody else can kind of give their two cents while I try to find this. But yeah, this is not the way. This is not what we want.
No.
So I think we agree on that. Now, we've all of us made that decision to have larger families. So we're doing what the government wants to encourage. So I'd ask you guys, what is it that brought you and your wife to that conclusion that you want to have lots of kids, that you're going to make the sacrifices, pay the costs necessary to be able to have a larger family? Because it's not easy. There's tons of things that you give up in order to go this path. So why did you guys decide that?
I think we should answer this based on whoever has the most children. They should be the one answering first.
Me and Ryan are tied.
You go first, Matt.
Well, I guess that's a difficult question, like, because what made me start may not be the same thing exactly how I look at it now. You know what I mean? But my wife and I definitely, just to comment on it, my wife and I waited a couple of years, and both of us are like, why did we wait, you know? Definitely without any flattering, these two guys were an inspiration for us to see children being considered a blessing, being trained, being disciplined, and the vision behind that. So I think over the years, it has grown way deeper in me to where I just see the entire question is flipped upside down. People are saying family planning, and it's like, you should just plan to have a family, you know? I could probably come up with some more little ones like that. Maybe I'll close off and let Ryan say something. A memorable quote I heard from a Catholic, and it stuck with me forever. And he talked about, he called it the intimacy of fertility. Great phrase. In other words, you're intimate with your spouse, great. So you go on trips together, you're sexually intimate, etc. What's even deeper than sexual intimacy? The intimacy of your fertility. Why are you withholding that part of you, which is actually the original Genesis blessing, and just being like, I'm not sure yet, you know? But that's more me now looking back. I didn't have that same frame when I started. Intimacy of fertility.
Boom.
Yeah, I think, I would say, like a lot of things in our lives, I started without the super deep reason. By God's grace, I had a love for kids by the time we got married. And that was not normal I was 23, I think, when we got married. And so I wanted to have kids. So we got married and we started having kids. But, you know, it's also, you know, I do feel like it was an obedience, you know, in Genesis 1:28, and God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely an obedience aspect of it. But yeah, also I'd like to, I mean, Psalm 127:3, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, a reward. And it's mm-hmm. like, they really are like, having children is one of the most amazing things you can do in this entire world. An enormous source of joy. And yeah, and you know, by God's grace, we've done a decent job training them and disciplining them, and that's yielded the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And so, having one, all of a sudden we wanted to have a two, and like, we didn't stop, we just kept having them, and so we have six. We probably would have had more. My wife had to have six C-sections, which also gives you, that's also a testimony.
Yeah.
They're incredible, and we still, and you know, and through all those surgeries, she still wanted to have more. And yeah, for those who get to meet our kids, the Lord has blessed us, and yeah, we don't regret any of them. So
yeah, I think on my front, when we got married, I mean, we knew that we wanted to have kids. And again, a big part of that is just, again, you quoted some of the verses, just like, hey, you know, God says this is a blessing. Our lives aren't our own. They're, you know, God has a bigger plan than we do. And so now, again, I will also say this. We enjoy practicing, you know, to have kids as well. I mean, that's just one of these things where it's a pretty enjoyable process. So, I mean, that definitely doesn't hurt the, you know, having kids either. So I think that's one thing. And then in terms of how many, I actually had this kind of cool timing, but last night I flew back in town, was out of town for a couple of days, and showed up. I get on my last airplane. We're getting ready to take off. And one of the last people on the plane is one of the professors, one of my wife's professors, college professors. He's a gay man. He is a, just like a gender, sexuality, like all the you know, all the wild things that you can study and teach. He's teaching, and he's a very brilliant man, really respected in his field. So I haven't seen him in probably, it's been a long time. I mean, maybe 12 years, something like that. He just happens to be getting on the plane. He didn't see me, but I see him, and I immediately text my wife, and I said, babe, you're not going to believe who just got on the plane. And so I told her, she's like, no way. I was just thinking about him the other day. So we get off the plane, and I just kind of waited for him. And I said, hey, you know, Dr. Boom, you know, and I said, hey, do you remember me? Like, you know, my wife was when he goes, I remember you. I remember your wife. And she goes, how are you guys doing? And so we start talking, we catch up, you hear each other's stories. And then at one point I just tell him, I was like, yeah, actually Sarah's, you know, pregnant with our fifth. And he goes, whoa, like he just like reacted like it was the craziest thing he'd ever heard. And so again, that's like the culture's broad perspective on having kids, is that it's this crazy thing. It's this overwhelming burden thing. And obviously, like there are moments where you do get overwhelmed, or moments where you're, you know, where things are hard. Children are their own blessing, and they bring, and they accompany a lot of other blessings as well. And so, and again, these aren't just abstract blessings. Like many things, Christians tend to solely spiritualize these ideas of blessings. There's plenty of physical blessings that come with having kids too. I have another buddy who has one kid, and he told me one time, he's like, I don't know how you do four. I can barely do one. And I said, bro, you have it all wrong. Having four kids is easier than having one kid. Because like they entertain each other. My two oldest, you know, they can change diapers. Like we do, it's yeah. way easier to have more kids because you can all work together and carry the load, you know, share the load. And so I think that's just another thing, is our culture does not have any concept of, to the point that you guys both mentioned earlier, they don't value what God values, so they don't even enter down the path. But then I think another thing is that a lot of people just don't understand, and they're not thinking long term. They have a very high time preference when they're thinking about having kids. So one of the reasons why people have had kids throughout time is because they knew they were going to get old and sick and eventually die someday. And so kids would help protect you and provide for your needs when you got old. And this is something that just most people don't even give it a second thought to. They're just totally presuming that maybe I'll have kids someday, and in the worst case, I'll just go into a nursing home and I'll be able to, you know, I'll be able to pay strangers to care about me, to take care of me. And I just think, again, this is one of the consequences of fiat currency, is that you're going to have the cost to be able to do that is going to get prohibitive, even more prohibitive than it already is now. And so I think that promoting these kind of conversations is something that needs to happen. Like, people just, this is a cliff. Again, it's not just the demographic cliff. There's this coming cliff of people not having people to take care of them and waking up to that reality. It's going to be a rude awakening for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You mind if I respond to that? I'm trying to crunch it down in my mind what I want to say. It's too much. But so quickly I'll say, I went to China when I was a kid. I grew up in the Philippines in Asia. I went to China when I was a kid. Three boys, me and my two brothers. And that was during the one child only policy. And so we were like royalty over there because, you know, for them, to be as crude as possible about it, they're killing off the girls to try to get the boy. You know, I mean, that's the reality of when you have stuff like that, you know, and that's the reality of, I think, all sex selection abortion. People, you know, you have a movie star that's like, we chose a girl. That's like a obfuscation of what really happens. They're killing the girls to get the boys. So for us, it's like, we're billionaires. Here's a family with three boys. Wow. Mm-hmm. So everywhere we go, skip ahead, 2023, we went to Italy. My family with five at the time, now we have six, and that we got the same treatment. You know, it wasn't one child only policy, but upon returning, we found out that's the lowest birth rate ever in Italian history. Wow. 2023.
Yeah.
Now we're going back again this year with six, but the response, and I think this, I think I'm tying back to the first point about Trump's policies and also the, not futility, but the inadequacy of it. You know, you know, I'm in Italy and people see we're a big family and there'll be a guy my age like, well, this is just like Italian families, you know, they think of themselves as having big families. And, oh, do you have any children yet? Oh, well, no, not me, you know, but this is so much like an Italian family. Okay, where? There are none,
yeah.
You know? And we went to a village that actually did have a school, so there were some kids. That's where we stayed with family. But even then, we're walking down the street, cars, 3-point turn, pulls back around. Are these all yours? You know, my wife speaks Italian, not me. Yeah. And it's a big, it's an old, they're all old.
Wow.
You know, that's why they were dropping during the pandemic, and they're just all old. And there's women, ladies with tears in their eyes, bambini, you know, come over here and let me kiss your cheek. And one of the old timers even was like, you know why no one has, they're not having children anymore? They don't believe the Bible.
Wow.
That was what one of them said. And so there's these elderly that are just like lamenting. And of course it does have, I'm sure that the economic policies affects people having children. But I guess to bring my sermon to a close, you know, land the plane a little bit. The economics will help, but you're like 20 years behind in my view, because I just saw an article that I reposted on South Korea. You know, imagine you're a young Christian guy and you're like, oh, I know what I could do. I'll go get a rad South Korean wife or something like that. You know, I don't know. Just throwing out there, like, imagine that you even want that. But you've grown up in a culture where no one you know has kids.
Yeah.
Your parents didn't have a lot of kids. It hasn't been considered a part of the culture. It hasn't been, like, visible. And you're like, yay, I want to have a big family. Like, what's going to... But, I mean, I'm talking realistically. What's going to happen as you start having kids? Like, it's not gonna exit your culture. You'd need, like, a literal miracle to have that be a really healthy situation. So, fellas, don't go try to get a 10 in South Korea, because there's no, you know, good guys out there. It ain't gonna work, unless you find a miracle, because the culture in Italy, the culture in South Korea, the culture in China, those economic policies are not gonna do ultimately the trick, but they will help families that are having kids.
Yeah. So even mentioning South Korea, and I've talked to some South Koreans. We were just there last year, and they're having this huge demographic issue, and it's actually a social contagion. Mm. Like, it's spreading through social media, TikTok, and all this. And that reminds me that it goes in both directions. That we could feel the courage to take those steps of faith, to believe God's word, that children are a blessing, and to be like stinking poor.
Right.
Like, genuinely, are we gonna pay the bills? And yet, let's have kids.
Right.
And to trust God for that, and then to me to say, okay, I want my wife to be able to stay home. I don't want to just have kids and then farm them off to the state to indoctrinate them. No, I want us to educate them. I want them to be influenced and shaped through my home culture, not the state's pagan culture. And so I got to work hard. I got to figure out investing. I got to figure out Bitcoin. I got to get a side job. I got to raise support.
Can I throw something in there, Ash?
Yeah, do it.
And you got to have faith. I'm not going to jump in your thing, but just that. Isn't it parallel to the walk of faith? You get what you need when you need it, not before.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. We want it all provided for and figured out and budgeted. Yep. Oh, and then I will make the decision to have a kid. No, no. Actually, there's a reason that the kids come as a result of something that you do within a healthy marriage. It is not planned. I mean, maybe if you're so overworked and busy, you have to plan your intimacy with your wife. Like, okay, there's a place for that. But actually, it's best spontaneous. It's best as it's just a part of life. The same thing with children. They're best as the result and the blessing. We do our responsibilities and the things that God gives us to do, the work that that our hand finds to do, and then he does the blessing, right? Do the work, let God cause the growth. Mm-hmm. We're trying to manufacture the fruit and control the fruit, and he said your job is to do the gardening, to do the hard work, to do work the land. I will bring the fruit.
Sow the seed.
Yeah.
Sow the seed, lots of it. That's what we do around here. And he brings the fruit, and it multiplies, and it is a blessing. And when you believe it's a blessing, you trust him, God is honored, and then you get surprised by all these unintended results and blessings that come from the life and joy of a full quiver, of a full home. And I'm in this church with a bunch of really young families and young guys. And it's actually interesting. So there's a lot of, about a third of our church is Eastern European. And so they come from, similar to the Italian families. Within their culture, there's that high value of family and tradition, right? But they're now in America, and they're in the Northwest, where you have this anti-family, anti-natalism view. And so they see me with all my
Oregon's
kids.
One of the lowest birth rates in the U.S. I think we're the third worst.
Yeah, it's like it's definitely on the coast, right, where it's so bad. But so these families see that, and they're like, wow, this is amazing. How do you do it? I love your family. It's beautiful. And I just tell them this. I said, here it is. Here's the secret. You ready? Take notes. You ready? Above three is free. Above three is free. It's easy after. Just get through the first three. It's really, really hard.
Yeah.
You get over it. You get to number four. You just keep adding them. Once you've already made that upgrade to the suburban, and you've got one that's at least 8 years old that's going to help take care, it's free.
Now you're in the transit phase, right, Ash? I got the Cadillac now, but if we have any more, we're gonna be needing to get one of them youth group vans.
I think we've hired a babysitter maybe three times in the last 19 years.
Yeah.
Our oldest son started babysitting all the youngers when he was, I think he was 11, something like that.
Yep.
And so, like, my wife and I would start going on dates because, like, we just taught him how to use all the phone and, you know, so he could get a hold of us. And Yeah, so think about that for a second. We have six kids, and we've had literally a handful of times, and we've had our friends watch, you know, the kids a couple times, and my grandparents here and there, and but never having to pay for a babysitter for 19 years.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things, and then also just like we homeschooled all six of them all the way through, and we just, you know, we do that frugally. Yeah, my wife stayed home with him. I mean, probably one of the biggest things. Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about a bigger place for families to live, and a wife that's willing to stay home and be with her kids is, I would say, one of the biggest factors in an increased family size. Because at the end of the day, yeah, as soon as it gets really, really hard, as soon as that changes. Because mom and dad aren't with the kids anymore. And I'll tell you straight up, that leads to behavioral issues. And the more behavioral issues there are, the less incentive there is. The thought of having another child is like, oh my gosh, well, do we want that much more chaos?
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just like, that's so, yeah, it starts with your a spiritual belief. It starts with obedience to God and His word. But it also, how you raise your kids and who's raising your kids really matters. And if you do it well, you can have a peaceful home. And if you have a peaceful home, having more kids is a huge blessing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not peaceful, bringing in more kids is a curse. It's straight up. If they're little monsters and they don't listen, there's no respect for parents. And straight up. And then all of a sudden, our culture, they see that, oh gosh, I don't want any kids. See these little terrors, and that's not incentivizing. Just look at the incentives. There's a whole bunch of things that have to line up, and the Bible is very clear about those things. And so it's not super complicated. We just need to be humble and obey God's word.
I will say, okay, so there's some people listening. Maybe you have zero kids. Maybe you have one kid. Maybe you have two kids. God has allotted different faith, different amounts of faith to different people. So God, it's not like if you're out there and you're like, I can't even imagine because of my wife has this debilitating illness, or because, you know, my parents only had one kid. I'm a single kid or single child. And so I can't even imagine. This is not to put all kinds of debilitating pressure on you.
Right.
What this is just recognizing that, you get basically conditioned by your environment. And we live in one of the most anti-child environments in world history.
Yeah.
It has never been more strange to want a lot of kids, or to want to want more than three kids. You get looked at like an absolute weirdo because our culture has conditioned a certain level of a certain level of monetary wealth, a certain level of, ability to do certain types of things outside of just existing. If you don't, how will we pay for three travel sports? How will we do all the, And so there's a lot of this stuff that, again, it's basically depending on what your values are, you're complicating or simplifying your life. And so there's lots of things that, again, we could all give examples of this. There's lots of things that we choose not to do because we value other things more.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't, I played travel sports growing up. We traveled not every weekend, but many weekends. And so there were plenty of times where we just weren't in church. And so growing up, church is kind of one of those things where I didn't really want to go to church. I'd rather go play basketball or do whatever. And now we just we just don't even let it be an option. It doesn't matter what it is in terms of a sports. We just wouldn't do it. we do, sports just it plays a much smaller role in the lives of our kids than it did my life. And that's because I lived it and I see the consequences of that. There's many good consequences. There's many things that I, learned through playing those things, but there's sacrifices, there's opportunity costs. Part of living in the world that God made is that He made a scarce world where you have to choose either this or that. You can't, you can't get both. And so I think that's part of this is just going in with the going in towards having kids of just there's ways to have kids and there's ways to live with kids and expectations for them that is makes them more of a blessing, and that makes it much easier to navigate than our culture, based on the beliefs about having kids and based on the expectations that they put on, you know, your life, that you should have all these accumulating all these physical things or all these experiences, whatever. You don't have to have that.
Yeah, 100%. And that doesn't even go into all the FUD that started. I want to say it was back in the 70s. Remember what was the name? John Ehrlich. Anyways, he wrote the population bomb, and it was basically it was like fertility FUD.
Yep.
Basically, literally, they like. Man, we talked to a couple. I talked to a couple guys recently that were, like, they were basically forming their families when that book came out, and that influenced an entire generation to be ashamed of having a bunch of kids because they were going to steal all the world's resources.
Yep.
And they believed it like hook, line, and sinker. And like, you can literally see birth rates starting. I want to say it was early 70s, something like that, sometime in the 70s. But it all never happened. It turns out that as the population increases, efficiencies increase and innovation increases. Right. And all of a sudden, like, you go from like a single farmer with I know we had, farming equipment before then, but it's just like, farming has just gotten 100 times more productive. And anyways, it never materialized. And then there's other FUD, you know, it's just like, oh, did you, you know, it's like mainstream media. Did you know that each child it costs $1 million or whatever? You're just like, what? it's like, I don't even know if like my wife and I could dream up a scenario where we spent that much on our kids. Like, and like, but like, if you're just on the surface, well, I guess we can only have one, you know, or I guess we won't be having any kids. And obviously that's which brings us back to the point of why your motivation for having kids has to go deeper than surface level. Mm-hmm. It can't just be economics. There has to be something.
I think your point, Jordan, is really pastoral. And like you said, if there's someone listening who's younger, doesn't have kids or whatever, is it's not about legalism. It's about saying the entire frame is flipped. Yeah. In our culture. And the question that's being asked is like, can I afford to have kids? Are we ready to have kids? These are the questions being asked. And I think what you're saying, or at least what I'll say, is the question needs to be flipped. What is my very, very good reason to not have children?
Yeah.
You know, and yes, like disease could be one of them. Illness, you know, Paul talks about like persecution and Christians being murdered, that's a good reason to try and get to some places a little bit safer. But if you start your questions from the kingdom of God perspective, which I'm promoting and saying, it's the flip side question. And these are not like, these are not pretend people. I had this conversation like less than a week ago with a young lady who's expecting a ring as soon as she arrives back home on the mainland. And she was just honestly from a whole heart asking me, and she's prepared her career to be able to have kids while having her career. And, and I gave her this same speech, but in a very, I hope in a very like winsome way, like with the, you know, sort of the conclusion of what I said earlier, isn't it part of the walk of faith too, to say, hey, we're going without a knapsack and, I don't have an extra tunic. And then when I arrive in town, someone's going to greet me and they're going to put me up in their house. And then you're just going to preach the kingdom of God and you're going to cast out demons. And I'm not trying to apply that story to everything, but it corresponds to the walk of faith to say, if my children need provision, God's going to provide a way. And I'll just stop talking there. But
I have some friends. They were missionaries with New Tribes Missions. They went to a jungle tribe shortly after they got married. They were there for, I believe, it was either 5 or 10 years before they had kids. And the reason why, like, they wanted kids desperately, but the reason they put off having kids is because the rate of illness and death among people who live in that tribe is insane. Mm-hmm. And so they just basically said, all right, we're going to give ourselves. So they worked like 12-hour days, sun up to sundown. They basically worked harder than anyone in the history of New Tribes missions, like to the point that they were accused of being too radical. And they ended up like they translated the Bible. They taught people to read and write their own language, preach the gospel to them. Almost everybody in this tribe believes. And then as they, you know, as the people start growing, they start sending missionaries. And then at that point, they start having kids. I believe their first 5 or 6 kids were boys. And they had the exact same thing where the people were like, oh my goodness, like, you guys are so blessed of God. Like, they had some, there was like some like ancient myth in this culture where there was somebody who had 5 or 6 boys and they were like some humongously favored person. And so it actually enhanced like the people's respect for him, which they already loved him, already respected him a ton. They're like, this is insane. And so I think, yeah, I just think that there are reasons to put off having kids. There's things like if your wife has certain illnesses or something, or if you have certain illnesses, like there's, I go to church with somebody who, you know, the wife had a actually choked on a piece of food. And it was totally normal and healthy and had choked on a piece of food, couldn't breathe for a period of time, and basically woke up and basically they are like permanent damage done from that. And so they have one kid, and I don't know. Actually, I don't even know if they're going to have any more kids, but it would be very difficult. So it's just one of these things where like these aren't like cut and dry rules. And at the same time, you should be thinking, like, again, we have a friend who we were having this conversation with, you know, parents who love her, but she just had never thought about this issue. And so I told her, I was like, one of the reasons why we want to have, you know, at least 4 kids is to enable them to share the load of taking care of my wife and I. Because, like, even if you have 1 or 2 kids, that still is a lot for them, you know, for them to take care of you and your wife by themselves. Mm. And so... So these are all just helpful, you know, we hope, like, things to think through. We've been talking about this one for a while. There's a whole nother tweet thread. I found the tweet thread. We can just kind of put it in the show notes. But it raises a whole bunch of other points. Like, one of the things it mentions, I'll just mention quickly, is it talks about infertility. Like, 1 in 7 couples in the United States deals with infertility. And so there's health reasons behind that. There's nutritional reasons behind that. There's all kinds of things.
That's a whole nother conversation about birth natural? Control. And hormone birth control, and actually, not a psyop, but like I would say, an inside job from Satan to destroy the human race through birth control and that movement and what that does. Everything in our culture is trying to destroy man's testosterone and his ability to lead as a man and destroy a woman's fertility. And it's literally a demonic attack.
Yeah. Well, and again, part of this, this sounds like the fact that you would call it a psyop or a satanic psyop, but it's like, no, think about it. This was actually a targeted thing that was done after World War II, is because if you have a husband and wife in the workplace, the GDP is higher. Your numbers look better. And so, like, again, there's this whole idea of, even if you're looking at a national level, like, the idea of GDP as national health is a total, like, it's a total misnomer. Like, it's one factor, but given that that's the case, like, again, because if you had a country where, you know, where it was only, and we wouldn't want to enforce this, we're not trying to advocate for that, but if you had a lot more stay-at-home moms or something like that, at least on paper, you'd potentially have like a lower GDP, but there's plenty of other factors of ways to determine the health of a nation than just the dollar denominated version of this.
100%.
And a lot of people just have never thought about this. And so they, you know, they're just going along. They're like, oh, you know, this is, even as a societal level, this is something that we have to do. This is for the health of our country. We have to, you know, sacrifice and you know, just spend time working and work for the benefit of everybody.
Yeah. And it doesn't, and the second order effects of kids not being raised by their parents, like, what are they?
Oh, man.
It's devastating. Like, I'll just say straight up. I mean, public school environments aren't always positive, you know.
Ugh.
hard environments for kids. And and then you look at our culture and we have, like, what is it, we're over a million overdose deaths, like, per year and climbing, now on top of record low birth rates. So it's like, whoa, dude, like, what in the world's going on? And deaths of despair, suicide.
People in their early 20s don't believe they're ever going to be able to buy a house, you know, and imagine what that does. And I'm telling my kids, I'm going to move into the Airbnb, and whoever has the first kid gets to choose where they're living, you know?
Yeah.
Whoever makes the first grandbaby gets to choose.
Well, and this, again, this...
And they're living in my house, and I'm going to just walk across and, you know...
But this does get at, so again, it's not that finances are everything. It's not that finances are nothing. It's like finances do matter. And so faithfulness with your finances and faithful to invest well and do these things, it does matter because it does allow you to do the rest of the things that the scriptures talk about, which is to leave an inheritance to his children's children. Like you can be an extraordinary blessing to your children by setting yourself up well. And again, that doesn't require tons of wealth. Like if you're able to purchase houses at the right time where you get them for cheap and then you have these resources that you can lend out for the benefit of your family. Like that's an incredible resource. I just think it's not, again, it's not like I looking at these things like, oh, we have to do them, you know, or like if we don't do this, then we're sitting. It's like, no, think about what Matt just said. Think about the blessing that he can be to his kids by the fact that he's willing to take the house that he said, and he's like, I'm willing to live somewhere else. I'm willing to live in some place smaller, less convenient for me personally, because I value our family. Like that just that level of thinking is just radically transformative. I mean, that's incredible.
Amen. Yeah.
All right, Matt, you want to share yours, man?
Oh, mine? Yeah, my quote. Well, so to me, this was a probably every now and then you get a quote you always remember. I'm pretty sure I'll always remember this one. It's like the fertility quote, you know? And it was, I guess I found this guy on a podcast. He's like a storyteller guy who is an Orthodox Christian, big O. Anyway, his quote says, Dr. Martin Shaw, bad storytellers make spells, great storytellers break them. And I thought, wow, that hit me in the sense of if you hear the first phrase, bad storytellers make spells, and then it's kind of like, okay, so what is a good storyteller? That they like make even bigger ones, or they make worlds, or, you know, and he says they break them. And I was like, wow, that's totally true, I think. And, you know, the gospel being the greatest story, but even if we don't have to go there, it's this idea, and you know, there's a political element to it too. You know, we're all telling stories through politics, and this even corresponds to our previous conversation. You know, oh, don't have kids, you won't be able to travel as much. Well, that's kind of a spell. I'm not trying to always bring it back to the first point, but that's kind of a spell, and if you want to break the spell, you got to tell a better story. I think that was powerful. I think I'll remember it.
Yeah. Wow.
I love the play on words. So if you guys have read C.R. Wiley's Tom Bombadil book, he goes into this idea that and Tolkien does a lot where words are powerful, and in fact words cast spells.
Mm-hmm.
Uses the analogy, right? Spelling. If you spell a word, there's actually this within the etymology there, there's this magical element of words are powerful because they contain ideas,
right?
And ideas transform minds and thus actions and thus the world,
right?
And so here, as I'm just hearing this quote for the first time, this idea that that you have a storyteller that, yeah, they're going to cast spells. These stories, these narratives shape who people are.
Mm-hmm.
But it may or may not be true, right? You can be, if that casting, someone's under a spell, often there's a deception, there's something being acted upon them. But what's powerful is to be able to set people free from these false spells that capture them.
Yep.
Yeah,
and if I can make a little
that's a fantastic quote, and yeah, touche on all that, Ash.
if I can make a little plug for Protestant, you know, this is something me and Osh talked earlier this week about. For all of our potential Catholic or other Orthodox or whatever, this is the power of what happened in the Reformation and how we believe we hold claim to the oldest thing. Because the oldest thing is not the institution of the Roman Catholic Church, several thousand years old. And the oldest thing is not the traditions of the apostles. The oldest thing is the very words of God. And the salvation plan and who he is. And the thing that shapes culture is not the institution, it's the idea. And by idea, I don't mean it's just an idea, but it's the truth. And that's what brings freedom from slavery, literal freedom from slavery, and a culture that loves and protects women and all the other advances, including scientific advances. So it's the ideas that do it. It's not human power or hierarchy.
Yeah, and again, like this shouldn't be controversial. Like, I'm sure that it will be to some people, but like, this is something that you saw with Israel all through the Old Testament. Like, they had the correct institutions. Like, the priests of Israel were the priests of God. They right. had all these institutions. Yeah. They had all the things. They had the sacrificial system. They had all the things, and there was still rampant unfaithfulness at certain points of its history. These impressive outward institutions can look good and, you know, used rightly are good, but the institution itself is not an indication that this is somehow good in of itself or faithful in and of itself.
Yep.
Anybody else want anything to that? If not, then I'll go to our last one here. So our last one has to do with I was able to search around and find it. Has to do with the Christianity Today thing again, and of course now I can't find it again. It's over here. Let's see. There's a different one. Of course, right when I need it, I can't find it. I think it's this one. Yeah. Let's try this. Okay. So here we go. This has to do with Christianity Today, and this has to do with money. So that's why I thought it would be a good one to do in this context. So here we go. All right. I'm going to read this thread, and then we can kind of chew on it and chat about it. People ask me, this is Josh. Shout out to Josh Abitoy. He's the founder of Ridge Runner, new founding American Reformer, lots of cool stuff. They're actually going to be sponsoring our friend TGFB Friends and Family Barbecue this coming month in Las Vegas. So go get your tickets. You can find them via our pinned tweet on Twitter with the Thank God for Bitcoin Twitter account, or you can find tickets at our tgfb.com/store. But Josh says this: people ask me all the time how Christianity Today gets funding despite having wandered far from its founding mission, as it recently showed with this Easter debacle. The answer is complicated, but in short, you fund it. Buckle up for a thread on institutional reform. One of the ways Christianity Today is funded is through advertising. Christianity Today got $2.8 million in advertising revenue in 2023. You can go look at the actual documents on that. Of that $2.8 million in total advertising revenue, a material portion comes from Christianity Today's Christian College Guide. Here's their pricing sheet. Boom, we could look at that later. Let's talk about that college guide for a moment. It's very light on information, measuring only 7 variables per college. Okay, here we go. The nefarious consequences of all this is that a drifting school like Belmont is allowed to posture as being the equivalent of any number of faithful Christian colleges. Even so, many Christian colleges will continue to pony up advertising dollars for Christianity Today's fluffy guide. Why? Inertia. It takes time for the Christian college market to learn that Christianity Today no longer has an audience or a constituency, and no longer has the trust of Christian parents. Advertising spending is a lagging indicator with a long half-life. I'm sure that many of the colleges who spend money with Christianity Today from your tuition dollars, by the way, are well-intentioned. They just have no idea how bad Christianity Today has gotten, and or they aren't aware of better alternatives. This vignette illustrates the scale of the challenge that confronts those who want to fight for faithful, self-determinative Christian institutions. When an institution goes bad, critique is insufficient. You have to get its sticky tentacles out of a million cookie jars. You have to build constructive alternatives. And then he, you know, just basically talks about American Reformer. We at American Reformer have supported the work of P. Jesse Ryan at whatever that is, which is working to strengthen faithful Christian colleges. Late last year, CAFF published a college guide that blows CT's guide out of the water. With 150 variables measured on 250-plus Christian colleges, their guide is extremely informative, information-heavy, but also streamlined, searchable, interactive, and above all, independent, trustworthy, and relevant. I should also mention that it's free. In 6 months, their guide has surpassed the annual online traffic for CT's guide, but we need help. And so then he just talks about how, you know, you can support these guys. But what an incredible article. What an tweet thread here that just kind of demonstrates and just illustrates some of the challenges and some of the guys. It gives explanative power for a lot of those of us who just are dumbfounded that somebody like Christianity Today still has the power that it does. I think I just was really encouraged by it and really thought that a lot of other people might benefit from and might enjoy chatting about it. So I don't know which one of you guys wants to take the first crack.
Well, I can jump in, and it. So, what this reminds me of is all of the malignancy within Christian higher education, and so I'm not going to steal your tweet thunder, but there's been a whole nother conversation that's been going on around how many Christian colleges are closing, and it's a lot. Right. And it's the school that both Ryan and I went to. Ryan never graduated. He got a wife and moved
found
on.
The wife.
I dropped out after part of a year.
Really all you need. But just that the reality of how many colleges are closing, including our alma mater, and the finances are broken and the incentives are broken. Some of it is government fiat funding, and some of it, like you're mentioning, is these old institutions where it's in Christianity Today's their business model to advertise to these schools and to pump them up and to try to keep the money flow going so that Christian parents still think that most of these Christian institutions are actually worth sending your entrusting your kids to, and sending tens of thousands of dollars to, when actually, no, it's worse than a waste of money. It's actually going to cause more harm than good. Where I mean, there's an unnamed Christian school here in Portland that is the number one way that you can radicalize your kids.
Name them, Osh. What are we doing here? Name them.
I will. They're on their way out, and they will soon be on that list of schools that no longer can stay open. But just the reality is, like, how many Christian colleges are there actually that you should send your kids to? I think the list is very small.
Yep.
So there you go. That's my little rant. We can talk more about that in the future. And what will replace them? Because they're all going out of business.
Yep.
Like, dozens of them. And they're all funded basically by worthless online programs that fund their money whole residency programs. So, I know my rant.
Yeah, online education again, because there's so much the overhead is so much better that like they can take money that they gain from online classes and then pump that into, you know, the actual, you know, in present thing. You know, again, this is where Bitcoin comes in, because a lot of these things, it's not necessarily the fault of the colleges themselves. Like a lot of this is, you know, just the rate of inflation. The rate of monetary inflation means that if you don't hold assets or that are increasing in value faster than the rate of monetary inflation, then you're falling behind. And so again, my alma mater closed, I believe, last year. I think Osh's did too.
Early this year.
Yeah. So this is a very germane conversation for a lot of us. And again, even for those who do stay in business, and my alma mater is a great example of this. So my first year there was the first year they'd been open for decades. I don't even know how long, but like 50 years at least. It was the first year that they had offered business classes at this college. Now, we could have a different conversation about how actually Christian colleges might should offer something about, you know, something about business, because that actually could be a helpful thing. But the reason why they started offering these classes was because it wasn't just because they're like, oh, we see this hole in our curriculum and we want to enhance our students' lives by doing this. It was more, no, we are falling behind in terms of students applying to our school. Yeah. What else can we offer? What kind of other courses can we offer to, you know, open up our, you know, basically to try to, you know, fish in a different school of fish, basically. and so this is something that they started to do. Now, again, it didn't work because, you know, 15 years later or whatever, they ended up having to close anyhow. But so what you saw there in that case is you saw a school sacrifice its core competencies in order to try to survive. Mm. Right. And so, again, I'm sympathetic to it. And I think there's wisdom in it to a point. But it's unfortunate thing to have to do. And again, this is one of the ways, or one of the things that actually Bitcoin has a material effect on over time.
Jordan, do you mean core competencies? Could you define that? I just wanted to make sure I understand.
Sure. So this was like a Bible college. This is like theology. This is, you know, practical ministry, all this kind of stuff. You didn't necessarily, this was not, you know, Wharton School of Business. Right. So like they had to go out and, you know, find somebody to be able to teach these classes. And again, they took resources that were being used for, basically the point of the school was to equip people for ministry. Right. And they had to widen the scope of that goal, of that reason for existence in order to try to survive. Hmm. So that's kind of what I meant by that.
That's the exact story of Multnomah Bible College. Yep. That we went to in the early 2000s, that you went there to study the Bible, and then it got accredited. It changed the Multnomah University. It tried to add all these other programs. And then all the reasons that you originally would want to go there, and all the alumni that would be your number one givers and the number one people to send their kids there, realize we don't recognize this school anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you lose your donors and you lose your next generation of students.
Hmm.
Yeah, wasn't the reason for the accreditation, wasn't it wrapped up in like federal funding and access, like Bingo. The whole, it was like, again, it was like the fiat system of federal student loans and all the hoops that they would force the partner institutions through, which for a Bible school, they had to like completely change their stripes, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. The argument is you get accreditation, you go through all the hoops, you have a better product to offer, right? But now you've created this whole regulatory framework and you have to build a bureaucracy around all of these regulations that then add to the cost of doing business, which eventually puts you out of business.
And then meantime, I just heard the big Tim Dillon rant on the boomers the other day, and he did one with Tucker.
Joe Rogan. Oh, Tucker. Okay.
And the other one, too, on All In. But you know, so it just reminds me, this is like the boomer real estate kind of thing applied in a different way. And the part that's sad is there's probably a lot of good actors, you know, that are just honestly, I've been very blessed by one of the professors in a smaller setting. I took like a, smaller group class, Ray
Lubeck.
I've been very blessed by him. And even in some ways he's expanded my mind on the Bible in a good way. I mean, in more reverence and stuff. So it's not that it's all bad actors, but it's bad. It's perverse incentives. And then going back to the fiat kind of idea, no one could have predicted exactly how this would happen. But can I just boldly say that probably employers don't even care about your regular college degree anymore, unless you're going to work for the county. So, I mean, that's not even really anyone's fault. That's just progress of more truth, more freedom, more openness. And people are going to be saying, "What? Show me something you've done, you know, much more and more. Yeah. And show me your reputation and show me like, you know, I think it was even, who was it? I think it might have been Elon possibly talking about, I just ask people like, what are you into? Tell me about your life. And if someone doesn't know, have anything to say, it's like,
yeah,
you're boring.
Yeah. Yeah, this, I mean, what was, who else? It was Ben, Dr. Ben Merkel. He's the president of New St. Andrews College. He was just talking about this the other day, is like one of the other downstream effects is like once you start, if basically there's a saying, it's if you take the king's money, you become the king's man. Mm. Something like, or if you take the king's coin, yeah, you become the king's man or something like that. And so once you start accepting federal government dollars, basically you become, you get to the point where maybe it's in the beginning, it's, you know, we don't really need this, but we'll do it. It'll make our lives easier. And again, I think there, we can talk about, like, can there be some strategic wisdom, you know, in this to a degree? But basically it's, but if you get to the point where you're having to make choices over, listen, if we continue to teach this thing, we know that we're going to, if we continue to talk about transgenderism, or if we continue to talk about whatever, we're going to fall afoul of these, you know, of the federal government's restrictions on talking about these things, or there's a potential that us getting these dollars, which we've now come to depend on as an institution, like there's a potential that we could lose those. So then you start tempting yourself to cave on like what you actually believe and what the scriptures teach in order to try to survive. And you start to act as though your survival as an institution is more important than remaining faithful to the scriptures. And so it's just one of these things where you're putting yourself in a dangerous position. And so again, so New St. Andrews, there's a couple other, Hillsdale, I think, is one of these where they don't accept government money. They refuse to accept government money because they understand this process. And so they do, you know, other things to try to, you know, try to make, you know, try to keep the costs down and, you know, try to adapt to these challenges in other ways. But, you know, so yeah, there's still thoughtful people out there. There's people and institutions who are, trying to be faithful and trying to navigate and doing them in new ways that are really neat, that are worthy of support. But it's a rude awakening for a lot of institutions and parents as well.
Yeah. You mind if I say something about going, we're still on the topic of the CT, but
this is your podcast, my dog. You don't need to keep asking. I promise.
It reminds me of, it reminds me, first of all, just a quick note. If I'm not mistaken, the writer of the book, Christianity and Liberalism, is who started CT. So it's like, wow. Correct. But
J. A. Gresham Machen.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Was it Machen? Yeah, yep. It was Machen. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, Carl Hendry.
Carl Hendry was
their first senior editor. Billy Graham was a part of starting it. I mean,
I'm so sorry. Yeah. You're correct.
So, but here's what I was going to say. Like, if I was going to try and steel man Russell Moore or those guys, I would say, look, I'm in like Paganville. You know, no one's ever heard the single true thing about Jesus. Okay, I'm in a different context. They're in the Bible Belt, you know. They're trying to make sure that they're reaching out to the world and saying, hey, bad stuff really did happen. The SBA had these scandals. And is that the SBC? Sorry.
SBC.
SBA has a scandal with me. That's a different story. But anyway, the SBC has these sex scandals. And you need to know that Jesus isn't like that. And Jesus wants the rose and all this other stuff. And it's like they're sitting on the belt buckle of the Bible Belt, and they're trying to make sure it's relevant, and in maybe in some ways they're trying to challenge Christians, you know, hey, just because you're baptized doesn't mean, just because you live in Tennessee, Houston, whatever, doesn't mean you're a Christian. That's my steel man. That's as good as I can do. And here's my picture. It's a mental picture, and it's I use it here in my ministry. They're building a bridge, but they forgot to invite people across the bridge to Christ. Mm. So you don't just build a bridge in conversation and say, hey, we've made mistakes too. The SBC has these problems too. We understand, blah, blah, blah. And then you build a bridge, and then you're like, I like you, you know? The bridge is for you to say, hey, you should come over to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And we build a bridge, and you forgot to mention that you're supposed to cross the bridge. Now, you're not forcing people to cross the bridge, but you're saying, hey, I understand you. I'm a lot like you. We share all these things. We share these things in common. We love, we want to protect women. We want to have justice. Make all the connections you possibly can. I have seashells in my dreadlocks too. Whatever it might be. But you're still building a bridge in order to say, hey, Jesus is for you too. All of your great desires are met in him. You should come over and join the people of God. The kingdom of God, etc. So that's my picture. You can't just build a bridge and then not say, why don't you cross the bridge?
Yeah.
I'm reminded of John Piper's Passion Sermon. He's like, look, Lord, my seashells and my dreadlocks. My seashell dreadlock that's collection.
That's a good one. I found another little seashell. I think I'll put it in my dreadlocks. And what does he say? How does he come down on it? I can't remember his words.
Yeah, he's about laying your life
you're
down.
Wasting your life! You know?
Yeah.
All right, so we'll, man, we'll. I think we'll end it there. Appreciate you guys. Any other thing? We didn't have memes this time. We'll have to be more prepared. We'll have our memes, our favorite memes.
Can I end us with one pithy quote that kind of ties in everything?
Again, this is your podcast. Yes, you may.
Okay, so this is an Arabic saying, and it translates like this: if you let the camel's nose into the tent, the rest of it will follow. And so you never let a camel put his head in your tent.
Ready to go.
Or that's going to be your bedfellow. And that can be applied in a lot of ways, especially with government, in Christian education, government in the church. And
I need you to tweet that, and then I will retweet. That's a good one.
Well, we'll have to come back to the travel sports thing, too. I think that's a god... in our culture right now, and it's a huge thing, and it keeps getting bigger, and it keeps going year round, and the pull is getting stronger and stronger, and especially in the church. That'd be a really good conversation.
Yeah, man.
I think there's a lot of parents are feeling the massive pressure, and it's just like, what's going on? And I think that'd be, anyways, be good to share our thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would love to do that. I'm totally up for that. And since this is your podcast too, we can definitely make sure that happens. Anything else you guys want to add in closing?
I appreciate it, guys. It's encouraging to me, I mentioned it offline or before we were on this, but just being able to have male friendships and banter and hope maybe even challenges or sharpening is important. It's difficult to find in a lot of senses, and so I hope the Lord blesses with what we did today, and including us, but anyone listening.
Amen.
Yeah.
Josh, appreciate Matt, you guys. Ryan, appreciate you guys, and this will not be the last. We'll see y'all again soon on the Yet to Be Named Project.